Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, kidlit notables, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 142 with Timothy Young, author-illustrator most recently of The Angry Little Puffin, published by Schiffer Publishing. One of my favorite books of Tim's is the tantalizingly titled I Hate Picture Books, in which a main character complains to the companion reader about how he just can't stand all of the characteristics that basically we all love so much about picture books. Of course, in doing so, he thinks more and more about the books and has a bit of change of heart. It's a lot of fun, and Tim tells a lot of great stories about writing it and all that's happened as a result. I hope you enjoy a whole lot. Here's episode number 142 of the podcast with Timothy Young. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Tim Young. I'm excited to get to talk to you. I'm just going to say it, to get to talk to you again, two times in 12 hours.
Hello again.
Because of a recording snafu, but you're a lovely company, so I will gladly talk to you about how much I love your books.
Well, thank you. Thanks. It was fun the first time. I'm sure it will be fun again.
I have no doubt in my mind. Tim, you've heard this from me before, but it bears repeating. I love that one, in particular, one book that you've written, not only that you're close so I can recommend you to my friends, but that you have this great book that's just so easy to get people attracted to you, and that's I Hate Picture Books. I mean, come on, that's a title that I said to you. It just sells itself. That's something that – who doesn't want to read a book that is called I Hate Picture Books? Probably because as a librarian, that's a phrase I hear too often.
Well, it was one of those things when that title came to me and I decided that that's the title I was going to use. I thought, well, if I'm going to call a book I Hate Picture Books, I better write a pretty good book behind it or I'm going to get in big trouble.
I don't even know. What is that like to say to yourself, I need to write a good book? Like, have you even thought, have you had this idea for a long time? I feel like I'm picturing you staring this idea in the face going like, all right, am I going to be able to wrestle this bull to the ground? Am I going to be able to write this?
Actually, this one came flooding out of my head. I was at the New Jersey SCBWI summer conference, and I was sitting in a seminar where we were talking about parody in children's books, and I started thinking about this kid who would misinterpret his books, and then I thought of the title, and then I thought of some of the books that I could poke fun at, like, you know, Green Eggs and Ham and Where the Wild Things Are, and I just thought, oh my God, this is fantastic. And over the course of the weekend, over 2 days, I wrote almost the entire thing in my head.
Really?
Not paying much attention to anything else that was going on at the conference.
I paid for the conference, and the benefit is that I walked out with a fully fleshed picture book idea.
Pretty much. And then I drove home from New Jersey to Maryland, and that's – I tweaked it a bit in my head on the way home. That's where I came up with the twist where you know, of course, suddenly he starts to realize that maybe he doesn't hate his picture books, because I couldn't really have a book where he just hated picture books. It wouldn't really, you know, sell like that well.
Propaganda.
And then I got home and I just started, you know, drawing the some of the layouts. And really, it came very quickly, this one. I can't believe I wrote this book. It's one of those things where I look at the finished product and I think, wow, this is a pretty cool book. Oh, yeah, I wrote this. Wow.
My name's on it. I can't believe I wrote this book. I love that phrase, Tim. Well, why don't I give you a chance just to tell the listening audience a little bit more about what it's about, a little bit more about Max.
Well, Max, and he's named – the backstory that I came up with afterwards was he has all these books. He has over 260 books in the book. So his parents must love books, and they love him, and they named him Max after their favorite character in Where the Wild Things Are. But he's a bit angry because he's misinterpreting what his books are telling him. His mom reads him that book about the kid and his purple crayon, and he draws on the wall and he gets sent to bed without dinner. And it just goes from there to poking fun at all of the silly things that we've always realized, you know, we're kind of weird about picture books, but not to the point where we're actually going to, you know, make some of the mistakes that Max may have made. But as I said, in the end, he kind of realizes that, wait, you know, he's very passionate and he realizes that, you know, he does love his books and he's got to find them. So that's the story of I Hate Picture Books.
And the 260, 262, 200
is
a lot. Yeah. The book covers in there. It becomes kind of like an I Spy in your book, because they've got the phrase you've taught me. I like the way you say this, is that the covers, you had to make sure that they read well. I like the idea of reading illustrations, because that's what we do in graphic novels too. But the pictures read well, that even though they're like these thumbnail sketches, we know because of these iconic covers what they are. But it becomes, I mean, there are so many books in there that I love, and that are contemporary books, modern classics, and ones that I grew up with, and that I know that were passed down to me from my parents too.
Right, and that was the other level of fun when I started putting it together. I thought, oh my gosh, I could just put everything in here. And I started, you know, thinking about the books from my childhood and the books that I read my kids when they were younger, and the books that my friends are writing. And I started, you know, putting all of these different books in, and of course contemporary classics that kids today will recognize as well. And it was really a lot of fun for everybody to try to pick out as many as they could. And I even had a contest when it first came out that if you could name up to 40 books that are in it, you could be entered to win a dozen autographed picture books from various authors whose books were in there. So I got a copy of The Stinky Cheese Man, signed by John Cheska.
What?
Boy and Bot from Amy Dykman. And after 6 months, I had all these entries, and a nice young man from upstate New York ended up being the winner. He was the one who won the most books, but actually a librarian. He picked out like 100. He and his mom picked out like 170 books. But the grand prize winner was a librarian in Pennsylvania who won the dozen picture books. So I was very pleased about that too.
Dozen signed picture books. Amy Dykman, you bring up Amy Dykman. I love that you told me once that she doesn't like the name of your book. Or no, she can't say the name of your book.
She said to me, I'll never be able to tell you the name of your book to anyone.
Amy Dykman, the nicest woman maybe in all of children's literature, maybe the whole world.
It's true. And
she can't say that.
Congratulations
four-letter
to
word.
Her. On Wolfie, what a phenomenal start to a great
what
book.
It was a JLG selection, wasn't it? A Junior Library Guild selection, as well as being starred, reviewed all over the place,
and on the New York Times bestseller list.
And on the bestseller list, yeah, great too for Zachariah O'Hara. I love his art, and I mean it's good stuff. It's this is the kid lit world though, isn't it? It's so fun to see your friends succeed and achieve success, even though, you know, because you're never, I guess, really in direct competition with them. You are, because books sell. And
in a way, but it's fun competition. It's nice competition, and everybody's pleased for everybody else when they do well. When a good book does well, it's great for everybody.
It helps everybody. That's exactly right. I was going to say, it's like in the classroom, in the school, when we have good teachers, you can be excited about the way they're teaching or the ideas they come up with, jealous even of their approach and of the way that their class loves them. But
We all win when people rally around good books, good instruction, good stuff for kids. We all win.
And in a nice way, it gives you something to work towards. I love Beagle. You know, what a wonderful book Dan's put together, and well deserved of the Caldecott. Yeah, and he's raised the bar. And now we have to say, wow, that's really cool. What can I do next? You know, what can I do that's going to, you know, live in that world?
Yeah. And knowing too that those people are the same people like you, and no matter where they're coming. I mean, I talk to people all over the spectrum in children's publishing on this podcast, from people that are just having their debut to people like Dan that, I mean, Dan is one of the hardest working guys in children's literature that I know. And yet he still has that attitude, that mindset that he has to keep pushing himself to do better and to keep innovating and to keep telling his story. And it's just a great work ethic to know that exists in even these people that we respect, and maybe not to say put on a pedestal the way we do, but he's a guy that's a rock star to a lot of us.
Oh, it's true, and more power to him on it. And I because I understand. I listened to his conversation with you, and I completely get the feeling of, you know, this is the last thing I'm going to be allowed to make. No, people are going to find out that I'm faking it, and that I gotta you know, put in extra effort and make sure the next one is good, because, you know, they're going to stop me from doing these.
Right. But we said before that what that causes you to bring to the table, as long as you've got it reined in enough, that always wanting to challenge yourself, to push yourself, to do better, to see things from a different perspective, there's so much value in that. I mean, imagine being on the other side of it, where you're just like, everything I make is perfect gold. I'm done.
Turn it into the course. I've met a few of those
folks. So have I. I've met a couple of people that are, I mean, this is unfortunate in that way. You hear that adage that, oh, we all have a story to tell. Everyone should write a picture book. And those phrases, certainly, I think it's okay to tell people that are aspiring that they should write. But there are certainly some people that are perhaps too confident in their own stories without taking other feedback from their stories.
Or doing research as to what's been done already.
There you go, too.
And you can tell the same story so many different ways, and that's just fine, so long as you're aware of what you're doing. How many, you know, Three Little Pigs books have there been? And that's just, and most of them have been, you know, very funny, very interesting, you know, very well done. But you can't come at it as if you invented it.
Right. So, Tim, one of the things I love about your copy of I Hate Picture Books, and I'll let you share the story because I love it so much, but I know you know that I love this, is that you've got a great number of really special autographs in your copy.
Yeah, someone gave me the idea early on, shortly after it was published, to like, oh, you should, you know, get autographs in there from people whose books are in there. I thought, oh, that's a really cool idea. And so I wish I could remember who suggested it. But so I started bringing this copy around, and I've now got upwards of 70 signatures in it. I started off just having people who were in the book sign it. One of the reasons was Lisa Hernandez, who wrote Doggone.
Of New Jersey, SCBWI,
yes.
Too.
I felt bad because I thought I had left her out, and then I realized that the last minute I had added a bunch of books to the cover, and Doggone is on there. It's very hard to see. So I showed it to her, and she was very pleased, and I had her sign, you know, a page near there. And then I started having other people sign it. Allison Fermento, who I think you just spoke to, and Michelle Knudsen signed Where Library Lion Is.
Oh, Mickey, I love that book.
Yeah, and Stephen Savage, Where's Walrus? And then I just started, everyone I met, I just started, you know, handing the book to and letting them sign. And people started drawing their books.
Aaron Becker, PJ Journey, so, I love that.
I was at the Baltimore Book Festival. I met a whole bunch of people, including Tommy DiPaolo, who I got to sit across from at dinner.
And he was in Baltimore?
He was.
I had no idea.
He was the key speaker for that weekend two years ago. And so I got to meet him, and I sat down for dinner, and he sat down across from me, and I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. And I got to talk to him all evening. So he laughed at the book, and he signed it because I've got the quicksand book right there. And then Adam Rex drew Moon Day in there. And then the book kind of got handed around the table to all these authors who were there, and I hadn't met everybody. But the next morning, I'm looking through it, and there's Journey by Aaron Becker, which had just come out 3 weeks ago, and just that day hit the New York Times bestseller list. And I went up to him, you know, later that morning when I saw him, and introduced myself and said, hey, thanks for, you know, putting Journey in here, and told him how much I loved it. So it's been so much fun bringing this around. It's a great icebreaker. I was sitting next to Bruce Deegan at a book festival, and, you know, there he is with his table full of Magic School Bus books and Jamberry. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, that's Bruce Deegan. And I sheepishly handed him a copy, and he just laughed and laughed and laughed. And I was so pleased. So it's neat to meet some of my heroes and have this book to show them that they all seem to have responded well to. Nobody's angry yet.
Well, cause I mean, you're paying homage to them though. The way that, I mean, their work is immortalized because it's published, but to immortalize them in your own book, I mean, I don't know, that's huge. It's amazing. I mean, how good would you feel to just see that you're one of these 262 books that, I don't know, again, it makes me think that talking to other authors and illustrators, they talk about their influences, and in some cases you can see the influence in the way they draw or the way they write. But you also found the opportunity to put your influence directly into the book so that it shows back.
Right. And it was a very conscious effort. I went back and forth for only like 2 minutes as to whether I should actually show these books that we all know or make them sort of look like the books that we all know. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go all the way. And because I'm kind of, you know, poking fun at and paying homage to everybody, you know, I'm just going to put everybody's books in there. And the response so far has been just, you know, phenomenal. I'm very, very pleased.
How many signatures did you say you got?
70 something now. Because some of the people are now just like, they're doodling in it, or like, and David Lubar, who hasn't done a picture book, but he drew his autograph on somebody on the boys' T-shirt. So it's there. You know, I haven't gone back and counted it in a bit, but it's somewhere in the 70s.
And so you just take it every book festival, every event you go to.
Yeah, I do. I put a protective cover on it. And it's it travels with me everywhere. And I bring it to school visits too. And the teachers and librarians all get a kick out of seeing it, and the students get a kick out of, you know, especially because, you know, I'm projecting my book on a big screen, and they can see all the books.
Oh, so they can see it even better.
Yeah. And so they're pointing out the fact that, like, you know, I have Max is tossing a book away into a box, and I figured, right, if I'm gonna have him toss a book in the air, I better make it one of mine.
Oh,
the kids think it's hilarious that he's tossing They're Coming into this box, you know. But then all over the floor are all these very recognizable books that they're all pointing to and picking out their favorites. So,
well, and of course this must happen, but I'm just sitting here smiling at the idea of just being an author at a festival, at an event where there are a number of authors gathered, and just being at dinner with people that are people that you admire, people that you don't know yet, but that you know, you know, like with Aaron Becker, like you don't know, but you know that there's a special reason why this person's at this table, and that excitement of just how we get to discover new people, but also just that your life brushes with these people. And
right. And it was funny talking to him because this was his first book, and it had come out. And so for him, it was brand new experience to come to a book festival like this.
Oh,
you know, he wasn't
totally
quite sure what to do. Matt Davies was also there, whose book, I can't think of the title right now. It's about a kid and his bike, and it's hilarious. He's a political cartoonist, and it was his first book festival and his first book. He didn't even know whether he should read it to the crowd or if that would be giving away the story.
Oh, no.
Which was a really funny, cute human moment. Like, and we said to him, no, it's okay. You can read your book. They're going to want to buy it once you read it to them.
Right. And it's so cool, too, to hear how the author reads your own book, the way that you interpret it, the way that you perform it, if you will.
Right, and that's funny. And actually, I recently had an experience where I was at an event where the principal of the school decided she wanted to read my books. And I just thought, okay, it's a little unusual. I'm standing here, but you go ahead, read my books. And I thought it was fun to hear her read my books because I've never heard anyone else read my books before. So I thought that was kind of a neat thing for me.
I've talked about that with someone. Maybe it was with you in person or someone on this recording that I wonder about that idea, because there's some books that I love so much that I feel like I feel like I would love to perform, to read your book in front of you, in front of whomever this person is, just to see, like, hey, this is how we hear it, and this is how we share it, and this is the places that we stop to – I mean, because when I read a book, I get to read it often. If I'm doing it as part of a library lesson, I'm reading it 4 times in the same week. So you get to kind of build up – I mean, it's almost like – I don't know, being a comedian and going on tour and performing in front of live audiences. So you're tweaking the way you're reading it time after time. But
right. And sometimes I've done this a couple of times, especially during Read Across America events, where since it's Dr. Seuss's birthday, I read The Lorax to the kids as well as my books, because it's one of my favorite books. I happen to have an autographed copy where when I was in college, he put out You're Only Old Once, and he was signing books in Manhattan. And I waited online for 8 hours. And this poor man, everybody carried like dozens of books up to him at first. And then they started limiting it to 2 each. And then by the time they got to where we were, it was 1 each. And I felt bad handing him one book to sign. He looked so tired. He was in his 80s then. And but I have this copy, and now I get to bring it to schools and I read it. And even when I was in high school, I got involved in doing street theater, and we performed The Lorax for crowds at different events. And it was so this is like I've got some history with this book. And so it's very special to me. And to be able to read it to students is a lot of fun.
When you've got a history just doing other stuff prior to publishing, too. I know that you worked – I know famously, this is what I always love talking about, that you worked on Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, I was just so lucky. I got out of Pratt Institute art school, and within 6 months I found – someone told me about this company that was hiring. I didn't know what they were hiring for. I just knew they needed sculptors and people who can work in animation. And I went and I brought my boxes of sculptures that I had done in college, and they liked them and they hired me. And I ended up getting a job at Pee Wee's Playhouse. I started out doing like some of the toys that are on Pee Wee's toy shelf and some of the characters from Life in the Fridge, the popsicles and things that run around. And then, they put me in charge of doing the penny cartoons. And I did all the, clay models along with a couple of other people for the penny cartoons.
I know it all. I know all of that. And I'm just smiling so much inside. It just makes me so excited. I need to go back and watch them.
And it was great for me, too, because I met so many people through that experience. I mean, everybody in animation and in the arts was hired. That it was New York City. It was the late 80s. And everybody, was working on this show. And for years afterwards, I got work with various people through those connections that I made, including, jumping into the toy industry, because I met a woman who was doing some of the toys from the show. And I got introduced to the people at Matchbox Toys, and they asked me to design a doll version of Penny, which was my first toy design job, and I sculpted the head. It unfortunately never made it into the stores, but
But the show really was that influential, right? I mean, because, again, I was experiencing it as a child, so I just knew that I loved it. But the more I learn as an adult, it is that it looks like it was so far-reaching and that it became a pretty significant part of our culture at the time.
Yeah, and it's still, still making, the Blu-rays just came out recently. Pee-wee's doing another film on Netflix with Judge Apatow, who was a big fan of his when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And so it's still going. And it's funny when I mentioned this when I'm on a school visit, some of the kids know about it, some of the kids don't. But the teachers' eyes light up. It's like, oh, my God, that's great. You worked on Pee Wee's Playhouse. And it's nice to have a connection with them because they're, say 20 years younger than me, and they were watching it as children when I was working on it.
So I assume you did. You have a chance to meet Paul Rubin? Did you?
I did. I got to talk to him a couple of times. I didn't get to know him very well.
No,
but the funniest thing that happened was, here's this guy who's playing this like little boy.
Yes.
But physically, as a human being, his beard grows very quickly.
And really?
So by the time the end of the day would come around where they were filming, they'd be caking him with makeup to cover this stubble. So I was down on Canal Street in New York on a Sunday morning, and this guy walks up to me with a baseball hat and glasses and a full beard and says, "Hi, Tim." And I looked at him for like a minute and thought, who the heck is – oh, my God, it's Paul. Paul Rubens walked up and said hi to me, and he had just been filming Friday, and he had this incredibly full beard by Sunday morning.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, I heard him on the Nerdist podcast and talking about – I mean, you could tell that this show was his baby too, because he was talking about the way that I was saying to you earlier on our previous recording that flopped, that you know, everything was filmed on film, but then when they pushed it out to television, it was all through like VHS. So all of the archives and everything that they ended up selling was this lower quality. So I know that he personally was involved in re-editing, re-splicing the film itself to make this high quality Blu-ray. They essentially had to like re-edit play by play the entire series.
Right, and all the stop motion animation was done on film, on 35mm film. Everything was very good quality for the time. And you're right, you know, even though broadcast quality was nothing compared to that. So it was real foresight that they did that. But it's funny. It also reminds me at the very end of the show, it says Pee Wee Pictures, and it's all these little characters spelling out the name Pee Wee Pictures.
Yeah.
And Gary Panter designed all these characters. And he's the guy. Do you know Gary Panter? Famous.
I don't.
Underground Comics. He was like one of the biggest names in Underground Comics in the 80s. And he did a lot of the design work on the show along with Wayne White. And but I'm like, they realized they didn't have a logo for this, the end of the show. And it was like late on a Friday, and they come rushing in and saying, like, we got to sculpt all these characters. So I'm sitting there sculpting all these characters with Paul Rubens and Gary Panter and the director, Shut Johnson, up. Standing behind me saying, yeah, that looks good. Oh, yeah, that's great. And then they rushed it into the animator, and the animator made them all move. And it was just, you know, hilarious that it was like 2 days before broadcast.
Oh, geez. That's amazing. That's amazing. Okay, before our time is getting close to closing, but there's no way I can let you go without talking about your newest picture book, The Angry Little Puffin.
Thank you. Yeah, that's it came out this past fall. It's
newish, yeah.
It's very new, although to me it's been with me for a very long time. It's based on an actual event in my life. When I lived in New York, I went to the Central Park Zoo, and there's a penguin house there, and I was standing in there looking at the puffins. There's a great exhibit of puffins in there. And this guy walks over and says, "That's a funny looking penguin," and walks off. And I thought, that puffin's gotta be really kind of irked. He called a penguin all the time. His sign right there says he's a puffin. And so this story has kind of stuck in my head, and I finally figured out a good way to tell it from the puffin's point of view. He goes on a bit of a rant after, you know, being called a penguin one too many times, and explains all the differences between puffins and penguins, until finally someone comes along who knows he's a puffin, and he feels relieved and in love,
but, yeah,
you know, for the fact that somebody knows who he is.
It's hilarious, and I love the book even more knowing that the source was just you just kind of being observant and maybe kind of people watching a little bit.
And puffin watching.
Puffin watching. Puffin, to be fair. There was definitely puffin watching in there. I guess speaking of people watching, one of the qualities that's drawn me closer to you is your presence on social media, and specifically Facebook. I love being connected with people on Facebook, especially you artisty, illustratory types, because I get to see you make stuff. Because I still have that childlike sense of wonder that probably was from Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, watching them make stuff. And I love watching you make stuff. And Tim, specifically, you are making something awesome for the Angry Little Puffin for when you do school visits. And I think it's amazing because you Yeah, go ahead, please. I'm gonna get out of the way and let you share.
Yeah, I had this idea at the end of the summer because I've been a sculptor. I've done all this toy work and stuff. So I decided I was going to sculpt a puffin and make a mold of it and give copies of it to each of the schools that I do a school visit of. And I didn't realize when I got into it. I mean, in the past I've done, I don't know, like a half a dozen or, so school visits a year. And I'm doing a lot this year. So now, right now, I've got six more coming up. And I'm painting. I cast up another six puffins and I'm gluing them together and I'm painting them right now. So I put it up on Facebook that I was to show them the other day. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited that I'm doing so many school visits because I'm finding that I really love doing them. And the kids get all excited when I hold a puffin up and say, who's this belong to? And they say, you. And I say, no, it belongs to you. And it's going to live here in your library. And they get such a kick out of that. So I'm just having so much fun.
Of course they do. I mean, it's that, Tim. It's that. even as a grown adult, when we've had an illustrator visit our school, no matter what they're drawing on that giant pad of paper, as soon as the pen hits the paper, I'm like, I hope they keep the paper. I hope we get to keep it. That looks amazing. Is it going to be okay if I ask if we can keep it? Because there's something that lives and breathes beyond your school visit when you leave an illustration, when you leave something like that was created during our visit. It's like a memento of the visit. But here you're creating a 3D character that can be on that bookshelf, that can be on the circulation desk, that can be wherever, but it carries your story beyond that school visit, and it gives the kids something to talk about. I mean, for me, though, I think on the other end of it, it gives all of us librarians and parents that book school visits and things like that something to talk about, too, because I see that you visit this school and that here's all these smiling kids and here's this awesome puffin that they got for the library, and I think, I want a cool puffin.
Well, there's still time in the year because it's through the beginning of June. And as you said yesterday, you've got some snow days tacked on.
Yeah, we in Maryland, I guess all over the country, but especially in Maryland, we're tagging on a bunch of snow days.
Yeah, well, we weren't expecting what we got. So.
No, I love – I know you did a Kickstarter campaign to help fund some of the initial puffins too, and to be able to see that process is – I don't know. It's just neat to see that it's not even like – I'm giving you a puffin that I found at the dollar store. They were shipping all these excess puffin molds from China. No, this is a handcrafted thing. This is to me, it also speaks beyond you as just a picture book author and illustrator, but also to say that you're an artist, to say that you have this rich experience that you're bringing to the story. I just think it shows these kids, if you're always thinking about these kids, it shows these kids something even more, that it's not just writing books. There's so much more.
Well, and each one is unique, too. I mean, I made a whole bunch of different kinds of arms or wings for the puffin, so you could have different expressions. And each face I paint is slightly different. And so,
you're hand-painting them, yeah.
Yeah, so each one is unusual. And of course, I sign them. So, not that makes it worth any more, but they expect me to.
But they're beautiful, and I'm glad that you're able to publish these great books through Schiffer. I know you and I have talked before about some of the advantages and some perceived drawbacks of being on a smaller publisher, and really that I know we've said that it comes down to where is the best fit for your story? Who are the right people for you to work with? What is going to allow you to accomplish what you want to accomplish with this book? And you being as present and visible as you are on social media, there isn't perhaps as much of a concern about a marketing team behind your book as there is about being able to see your vision make its way to publication.
Yeah, Schiffer does. I mean, they're wonderful to work with. They allow me to do as much as I want to do it. And I'm kind of a, control freak in that I have all these skills, so I might as well use them. So I do the layout. I pick the fonts. I do the types, the treatments on it. A lot of the fonts in my books are hand drawn, based on, I don't draw every single letter, but I do pretty much everything. Enjoy, figuring out what the end papers are going to look like and putting those together. And it's just a lot of fun for me to do all of this.
And then to go beyond it and also do like the book trailers that you're making and things like that.
Right. And the website for supporting it and all this stuff and bookmarks and postcards and everything else that, needs to be put together to be sent out. And I enjoy doing it all. And I have all these skills, so I might as well use them. It would feel weird for me to, you know, hire somebody to do something creative when that's what I live for. Yeah. So, you know, and it's fun. And as you say, I mean, social media, I joined it to promote my first book, I'm Looking for a Monster, but I found that it's just so enjoyable to be there and reconnect with old friends and make new ones. And, you know, and I work from home. So I, you know, my office is, you know, kind of isolated at times. But to be able to get on Facebook or Twitter for a couple of minutes, it's like, you know, going to the water cooler for a break and, you know, chatting with some coworkers or friends or for a little bit.
Yeah, because it can be any social media, anything can be distracting. But to be able to go out for that walk onto social media, onto Facebook, and to see what your other friends are up to, what they're drawing, what they're working on, that's just a cool thing to be able to connect that way, because you are so isolated. Thank goodness for the internet to connect us that way.
And for me, I mean, I still feel, you know, I mean, I've got 5 books out now. But I still feel like a newbie. I feel like, you know, I'm just kind of snuck in. But I've been so accepted by people whose books I've been reading for years. It feels really nice to have friends, both, you know, people I've met at festivals or at events or through social media alone, to be connected to them and feel like, yeah, I belong here. You know, it's nice.
It is. It's a great group of people.
Yes.
This whole kidlit world and education and the way that we're connected. It's really nice. And I have yet, I think truly, to have a bad experience that everyone just is looking out for everyone else. And I feel like the more you step out and take a risk and show who you really are and the things you really love, the more you're embraced and the more you connect even more deeply with other people and find those people like you. So I can't agree more. I can't imagine being anywhere else, and I'm sure you're probably the same way, that you're around the best people.
It's true, and I like to tell people that, you know, I mean, a lot of people think, oh, this must be like your second childhood. Well, for me, it's more like the 6th or 7th. You know, having done all these really cool things in the past that were so much fun, too, and now I get to do this. I get to write books, and they're out there for people to read, and I get to visit schools, and you know, kids treat me like I'm some kind of a rock star. I just, you know, it's a blast, and I just want more and more. You know, I want to keep doing this. And doing more school visits and you know, it's just so much fun.
Well, I hope you do, and I hope we see more and more books from you, and I look forward to opportunities to cross paths with you in real life, because you're in Baltimore, you're close to me.
Yeah.
So even more, we mentioned this last time, but it makes the next question even more poignant, because you and I will be playing together if this ever happens. So let me
close
with.
Go ahead.
Let me close with Tim, I'm assembling an all-star Kidlit Dream Team kickball tournament, and I would love to know what one person alive or past from the Kidlit world you would want on your team and why.
Well, as I said, I'm not the best kickball player in the world, but I would very much enjoy participating, and I really do hope we get a real game going. But my pick is someone who's near and dear to me. His book, Are You My Mother, features prominently in I Hate Picture Books, but a lot of people have said to me after seeing it, like, oh, that's my favorite Dr. Seuss book. And it's not Dr. Seuss. It's P.D. Eastman. He's written some wonderful books, you know, Are You My Mother, Go Dog Go, that have been with me my entire lifetime. And I just feel like not enough people remember his name or remember him for the things he did. He gets kind of caught up in the whole, you know, Dr. Seuss continuum, and a lot of people attribute his books to Dr. Seuss, but P.D. Eastman is one of my favorites, and so I think he should definitely be on the kickball team.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you choose good company, and I appreciate that about you, sir.
Thank you.
Tim, this has been a pleasure. I'm so glad, actually, that I got to talk to you twice, because I learned even more the second time around, and I'm excited about not only all that you bring to the table, but the way that you pour that into making great books for our kids. So thank you again for coming on.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure both times, and we'll have to do this again. Hopefully not tomorrow, but again.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Sure. Take care.
Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes through stars or reviews. Doing so not only gives me helpful feedback, it also helps to bring new listeners to the podcast, and that's a very good thing. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.